more time we chat among ourselves, the less time we have with Endo. You know, these students at UCSB get a chance to rate their professors. And it's... I read it. And they're wonderful. They're wonderful. I'm only going to read you two, and you're going to blush. It says, Professor Duffy is a really enthusiastic professor. He's one of the best professors I have had while at UCSB. I love how he is very passionate about what he teaches and how he makes the text interesting. All right, and there, it goes on and on, but I'm going to read you. This one says, he's so cute. And delightful.
And he is.
He's totally understanding and easygoing and loves picking up people in lecture. But he's so sweet about it. And he laughs and he makes everyone else laugh. And he's just such a good guy. I hope he reads this and knows how he is loved by the UCSB students.
Please. Is there any questions?
We were just talking that he fell in love.
Oh, yes. I noticed that...
Just like Thomas Merton.
I don't know. Maybe it said something about me. I didn't do any research on that whatsoever.
Why did you just say love is evolutionary process?
Energy. That was him, not me. I didn't say that. I thought that was
interesting. Bringing it up.
The truth is, I don't know. I don't know much about that at all. This Lucille Swan, isn't it? What's her name?
Yeah.
Sounds like a future movie there somewhere. But
got a question here.
The honest truth is, I don't know. So, but why not? You know. Here's another one. Yes. Should I? I don't mean to discuss it. I think it's very interesting for us to speculate. But I don't know where it went. Yes.
I was struck by your comment with respect to the period of literature you study, which would have been the period of literature that he would have been reading.
Oh, that he lived through, yes. Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on who he might have been influenced by?
Oh, I could guess, but I mean, how could I? I mean, you know, if you've read Proust, for example, the most famous French writer of, you know, so the 1920s, who was kind of the French equivalent of Joyce, and then there were a whole set of French writers. There was a whole tradition in France of struggling with Catholicism, often of ex-Catholics or people who ended up going back to Catholicism, and there were lots of struggles in France that I don't know too much about between, you know, various shades of Catholic thinking. So I'm sure he read those things, but I don't know too much about it. More generally, though, you know, you think of this, what I call, in my world, what's modernism, is this movement, which you all know about, even if you haven't heard about it, like between 1910 and 1930, basically every art form, say painting is the easiest one to think of. You know, think of Picasso, right? He was at this time too, the exact same years. Picasso, when he was younger, painted relatively traditional paintings. You know, he had his girlfriend, his lover, he painted her. Then he began to blur the edges a bit, you know. But then at a certain point, he started painting her with an eye here and a breast here, and, you know, that's modernism. In other words, the art, you know, painting, for example, not just Picasso, every painter. In a way, they started going haywire. And this happened in literature with, say, James Joyce. It happened in music with Stravinsky or Shostakovich or whomever. It happened in lots of art form, you know, modernist architecture, which looks boring to us now, was very shocking in 1910-20. And this was right in the middle of this man's life. So the only person I refer to his in reading that I read about was this Henri Bergson, who was very much of that same moment, you know, kind of right around World War I. In a way, they were all shell-shocked by the horror of World War I, That was part of the reason everything got so strange. But also, there was a kind of, it was also the moment of tons of new technologies. The car, the telephone, the airplane, all of that stuff had just appeared. You know? So you had this kind of, it was a, you know, everyone says that our moment is a moment of great change and blah, blah, blah. But that in some ways truly was a moment of incredible change. And everybody was kind of, in a way, excited by it and frightened by it. And I think, as far as I understand it, the official Catholic Church were very frightened by it. And Teilhard de Chardin was a victim of that. You know, he wasn't allowed to publish his most important books during his lifetime. He was explicitly forbidden to publish them, and they were not published. Okay? So the story of how he was treated by the Catholic Church is, to any of us who believe in free expression, if we do, and we don't have to, of course, you know, he became a Jesuit, he could have walked away and done what he liked, but they explicitly forbade him to publish these very important and influential books during his lifetime, and they were not published until after he died. So you could say that as a result of their, you know, fear of the new, and the new was everywhere in these years, you know, all that art and culture, and it was all new. He was kind of, in some ways you could say, from my point of view, he was the Catholic modernist. He was the one, he was the Catholic Picasso, perhaps. He was going forward and trying to explore new realities. You know, what was the point of Picasso painting a human being in that strange way? Well, he was trying to say something that hadn't been said before about what it meant to be a human being. That's what this man is doing too, or not just a human, you know, about the cosmos, about everything. And the Catholic Church were frightened of that. If you read the history, I don't mean to impugn them completely, but think back. In the late 19th century, after Darwin and so on, I know, she laughed, you're right, she laughed. But think about it. Business infallibility, for example, was brought in the 1880-something? I mean, there was a kind of a, you can see the reactionary, you know, you can see the drawing up the drawbridges at that point. And it got more like that into the 20s and 30s. And I think the word modernism came out of a number of Catholic encyclicals, which were very against this kind of, you know, ideas of progress, which they called modernism, were bad. And we have our beliefs, and they are fixed and so, and, you know, please don't, you know, and if anything, we're going to make them more, you know, yes, like sexual fallibility is an interesting example. We are going to sort of stick to them. Which I think, to the extent I understand it, is still the view. In fact, maybe even more so now than it was then. We're in a suddenly new phase of that, definitely, as a reaction to Sebastian's too. And for better or worse. I'm not giving any opinion. So I think that this man it seems to me, for people who want to think serious, you know, who want to think theology for our time, it's kind of, you know, he's not just being a mystic either. I mean, I think I probably underplayed how religious, how Christian, or how spiritual he was. You know, I was just giving you a general overview. But I think it's really interesting that he wasn't just that, you know, that he was, what's really important about him, he was incredibly religious, and he was a mystic, more or less, right? But, you know, he was also, he was a great scientist. He would be a famous person in the 20th century as a scientist, you know, as well. And that's what sort of, that, you know, he in himself was reconciling the things that in some ways, you know, it goes back all the way to Galileo. You know, this tradition of fear of what started calling itself science. You know, at a certain point there wasn't this thing called science, per se. You know, but science got to be, okay, we'll tell you the truth about the world. And therefore, those people are just making it up. You know? Whereas, you know, the religious end. Whereas, Teilhard de Chardin, you know, he's going for this sort of great synthesis, seems to me. And that's what's incredible. I'm talking too much.
This is more a comment than a question. You know, thank you for that distillation of the Teilhard de Chardin thought.
Thanks. Just a few faults.
And I just wanted to mention, some years ago in the New Yorker, there was an article by one of their staff writers who, when he was a small boy, lived near Central Park, and he used to go over to the park every day, and he met an old man there, and they would have a conversation, and the little boy was very much taken by this man. And then one day he went, and he wasn't there that day. And that was in 1955, when Chardin died. So he was the person that this young man was talking to.
Well, yeah, there's another, I mean, the whole story of how he died in New York and everything can be told as a very tragic story. I'm not sure whether it was or not. But was it in this book or where? There was only one person attended his... only one person went with his coffin to Poughkeepsie. The Jesuit plot, you know, that he, it sounded like he, and he had asked to go back to France a number of times because he was getting older, and they refused to let him back. Not only did the Vatican, etc., refuse to let him publish stuff, but they sort of sent him off on his own to New York. Yeah, and I guess living on Park Avenue wasn't the worst of exiles, but you know, they could have sent him to worse places. But it's a sort of a tragic story, I think, in the end.
So how did it come to be published then?
His secretary.
What?
Yes, everything with his secretary. I heard it from Jean Houston.
Yes.
Jean Houston told you the exact story how she used to take daily walks with him in New York in the park. And she was 16 and didn't know his name. He had told her, but it didn't register because it was complicated French. And it's only after he died and she saw his picture in the paper that she recognized who he was. But she had a brilliant mind of her own, and he challenged her thinking. He kind of ran all his theories by her, you know, during the war. And so, anyway, and apparently he left it with his secretary, knowing that if he left it not to get married, it would disappear. That's what I was. But I wanted to bring up the mystical side of Teilhard de Chardin.
Yes.
Kind of as a counterpoint to the influence that his era might have had on him, and also World War One. His ultimate conclusion is the same as all the mystics, and they are consistent throughout history and cultures, whether you go 500 years back or in... maybe in a Muslim culture like Hafiz and Rumi, they all came to his life is about loving and community. And he just took it to a further stage by a further level by connecting it and resolving it with science. But we had another evolutionary science biologist here in our group, Elizabeth Sartorius, and she, a big opus, was a Galpin, also came to the same conclusion that ultimately there is something in nature which we would call maybe a spiritual presence, that nature, she called it autopoiesis, finds a way to resolve itself, resolve problems in order to evolve, no matter what challenges thrown at it. So anyway, I think at this point, my point is that modern fields, whether it's psychology, geology, paleontology, medicine, all seem to be convergent to the mystical approach, no matter when that mystical expression was.
Yeah, no, I'm learning from you. I think mysticism in our time gets a bad name often. You know,
it's misunderstood.
People don't comprehend it at all often.
They don't understand what it is.
Yeah. So, I guess, in my defense, I could say something like I'm a victim of that. You know, I don't know enough about mysticism to really say anything meaningful to you. The word in a lot of science, I think, that might apply to what you're saying, what you just said about... you know, they're the last things, would be something like sustainability. Again, I don't want to be skeptical, but I'm not. I mean, I think that's a beautiful idea. You know, that everything will come into a sort of a balance. How did you? This also
well, you said that there's a sense of survival within nature, that it solves the problems that are thrown at it. It seems she called it apocalyptic, and she's a scientist. And it took her 20 years sitting on a Greek island observing nature and recouping all of evolutionary history. And she said it's an optimistic approach. Of course, makes us all feel good.
Exactly. I mean, there's a lot of hope in it anyway, and that's fine. The little I know, and I'm sure she probably said a lot more to you, is that you know, within the fields of people who study say evolution, there's a whole lot of different theories. And they're all competing and they're still alive and presumably this may well be the dominant one right now. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it's the exact same as his. You know, that this sort of, I don't know, again, if that phrase is the ultimate phrase, everything that rises must converge. You know, that I think he still has a notion, not, in other words, sustainability in some ways implies stasis. That there is some sort of ideal stasis, and that anything that deviates from that is a kind of a problem that has to be resolved. Whereas, I think evolution as a notion implies actual progress, i.e. change. But change we should not be afraid of. You know, it's always fascinating to me to am I talking too much?
No.
I mean, let me just give you, I've brought this up once in the thing, and let me just, I don't know if it's, sorry, I might be going away from your thing, but how would I put it? It's one thing to think that you know the way I told you that story about how we have five senses and you know we assume and the senses lead to our feelings, you know, you smell and you touch, but if we have evolved then actually the human senses have changed over hundreds of years, right? We can accept that
for better
or for worse, but that means that when you're do you think that could happen in a few hundred years? I don't know. But is it possible that your great-great-great-great-grandmother didn't actually have the same senses you have and therefore had a different consciousness? And that our descendants will similarly evolve and therefore have different senses and therefore different feelings. So that the very term, say, like love, will actually change. And that what, therefore, the Bible 2,000 years ago called love is actually somewhat different to what we could imagine as love now. That it's always changing. Now, that would sort of contradict the point you made that every mystic comes to the same conclusion. Or it should contradict it, shouldn't it? Because I'm saying, no, St. Teresa of Avila could not have had the same mystical experience that, you know, if mysticism is some sort of relationship between intense sensuality, right? You know those mystics, you know? That means to be intensely sensually aware to the point where you become spiritual, right? I don't know if that's the definition of mystical
well,
life.
But they kind of develop the third eye. They see things that are not seeable to a certain.
In a way, could you not turn that around and say they're the ones who are kind of the avatars in the evolutionary story? That they're the ones who are kind of reaching into a new level of perception, if you want to go back to all that sort of 60s, you know, the Huxley language, the doors of perception, you know, that they're breaking away into some new perceptions. And that's okay, gets to be his point, as opposed to, oh, we should be afraid of it and we should go back to some sort of eternal verities. Mm-hmm. But I think at the same time there probably is a contradiction, because of course, you know, we have to surely say for ourselves, so at some point, isn't, say, Christianity, if we want to remain Christians, is Christianity not based on a set of texts or a set of, and therefore a set of eternal verities? You know, we may change, but God shouldn't change, would be sort of, I don't know, what if God is just, if God is truly just the omega force of material nature, what does it mean? Does that mean ultimately nature never changes? You know, there's some ultimate autopoiesis, auto adjustments going on.
We just have to learn more about it. Like Philip says, the church is just an infant.
Well, that's fascinating. Yes. That is a fascinating idea. Because, yes, in terms of, you know, if you ever have spoken to a geologist, just an ordinary, no offense to geologists, but just your ordinary, you know, some guy here in town who works for an oil company. There's another, you know, I've met geologists. The whole geology department is using this thing. They really think in terms, in these millions of years, thinking. You know? So, of course, once you think about that for 10 minutes, all of a sudden, 2,000 years of Christian history is like, you know, it's like those people who predict earthquakes, and somebody says, oh, but there was one in 1957. They say, stop. We're thinking these huge blocks of time, you know, that predicts nothing. Because they're thinking, you know, 1,000 years is nothing to them. You know, 4.7 million, you know, they'll talk about. That's when the Neoplacene rocks, you know, you've heard, have you ever heard them talk like that? So even there you get this frightening sense of what, of man, you know, of not man, woman, but, you know, humankind in the universe. We're so new. And therefore, no, almost nothing, right, yet.
But also, there is the ancient. And I'm thinking about your holy wells and your pilgrimages. And I just wanted to say a good word, because he kind of said some things about sanctuary on Chimayo in the beginning of his book. And that's one of my favorite places, pilgrimage. So I think, has much in common with your holy wells, because it was a place of pilgrimage way pre-Columbian.
Oh, as well.
And has been a place of pilgrimage for...
It'd be thousands of years.
Who knows how many thousands of years. And there is that sort of enduring folk religion that I can't say why, but there's something to it. And there's some kind of a resonance to places, which I think he talks about a lot in his book, as you mentioned, that is hard to explain, but it's there.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, I suppose you could bring it back in a certain way to the community story as well. Because, and this is to, well, just think about it. I mean, I remember arguing about Catholicism with some, you know, atheists about this, and just trying to give, you know, why go to a church and all that stuff. And what you realize, you know, and this is certainly true of these places, is that, you know, there's the place, and you're in touch with the place. But also, you're doing it with other people. So right there, there's a community. But you're also doing it with everybody who's ever gone before you. And let's go back to the ghosts last night. You know, you're doing it with your parents and your grandparents and their family. You're doing it with those people for thousands of years. You know, to sit in... You know, it strikes me less in Ireland than in some churches in Europe. You know, you go into some medieval church and you think, you know, people sat here or stood here wearing skins, you know, in the 6th or 7th century. And maybe before that the Romans were there, or the Etruscans or whomever. And you think, you know, by going in there and believing something, as opposed to going in just as a tourist, you know, I mean, in a way, to go in as a tourist, I get mad with them, you know? I think, you're going in here, and you're looking at this, and you're saying it's beautiful or it's not, and of course it is. But you know, you miss that chance to kind of be one with all those people who, you know, even if you accept what the atheists say and say, you know, it's all a lie. Say, even if you accept that, still the chance to kind of, to use the Christian language, to be in communion with those people over thousands of years in that place, doing something somewhat similar, you know, thinking about eternity in that place. That's an awe-inspiring, it has to be an awe-inspiring thing to do, hasn't it? You know, and obviously it puts us in touch with our immediate ancestors, but when you stretch it back, you know, and that's, it's one thing to say community, we'll make a community, a group of us here now, But also there is this, you know, there's community, I guess, with people who are long gone. You know, you're like, that's you know, the phrase, keeping the faith. You know, you're keeping the faith with them, too, at some level. No, I'm sounding too sincere. It's my own good.
You can still have that feeling.
Yes.
And be, you can still be a tourist and still have that feeling.
Very hard to hear you without.
Ah, take the mic. Yeah. Please. Go ahead, please.
Are you sure?
Yes.
This was just going to be a brief comment about the fact that a community can be without any religious or religious, and that you can still have that unbelievably communal feeling by something that has been in existence for millions of years. And I mean, I was just going to the Madonna Temple. It's like, wow. I'm not a Madonna, but it's just...
Yeah. No, it's true. It's a very striking one, yeah.
There's an energy. That's the word. Energy to the wells and to the...
But it is, as people would say, it's because it is what they would call a faith community, you know? Otherwise, it's just a room. You know, you can go to an open house on Sunday instead, and, you know, you might steal some ghosts there. You know, you know. But it's because there are people, I think anyway, there, it's because there are people, it's a beautiful place, it's a beautiful building, but also it's because there are those, I think it's nuns, right? You know, there's a group who sort of, you know, it's like the ancient Vestal Virgins or something in Rome, they keep the flame alive and therefore are connected. You're also then connecting to every other Vedanta temple. And every temple, I suppose, but you know, right? That they're keeping a tradition going as a group that you can sort of imagine.
And I guess that's what it is, that I can also feel that,
yes,
even though I'm not a Vedanta.
Well, when they, you know, there are like right now in various places in Europe, you know, these gorgeous churches filled with art, and the states take them over and they turn them into museums. Mm-hmm. You know, the mission in Santa Barbara should watch this. Mm-hmm. You know, they turn them into a museum, and it's. You know, if mass stops being said there, it does change. Mm-hmm. The place is a lot shinier and cleaner and everything is restored and everything, but, mm-hmm, you know, it's sort of frightening, actually.
I just want to make one last comment. Kalyan talks about collective unconscious.
Yes.
And, for instance, one of our teachers who comes here, David Rico, went to the Great Wall in Jerusalem. He's not Jewish.
Oh, yeah.
And he was going as a tourist, but he suddenly tapped onto this energy. It came on him totally unexpected. One thought came into his mind, oh my, the suffering of the Jewish people. That was the thought that came to him. And he found himself on the floor, writhing in pain, screaming out. He experienced the entire pain of the Jewish people that came to the wall.
Mm.
After a few minutes, it was over with, but it hit him like a ton of bricks suddenly. So there is an energy to these places that's unexplainable, you know, that's concentrated there.
Fine, yes, fine.
And
it's
part
of the continuum.
Who?
The continuum.
Yes. Both. Yes.
Huh? And I was thinking as we were going over this chapter 8.
Yes.
That, and as we're talking today, that there is, for some of us, there is this presence that is, you know, named Christ. And okay. I think somebody asked if Teilhard de Chardin fell in love, and I do think in everything I've read, he did fall in love with Christ. And there's this challenge that we have now, and that he had, where he said that the challenge was to unite the love of the evolving earth with Christ. And it's still a challenge of how do we do that, how do we reconcile that. And I do think it's our challenge today. It's fascinating that he was a geologist, and it's fascinating that there's the combination of this love of our evolving nature, and yet the love of Christ, and how do we bring that together.
Yeah, because also I don't know enough about him, but did he fall in love? I mean, I presume he did. Everybody falls in love. But, you know, it becomes a question of did he, you know, break his celibacy vows, etc. Or, you know, and presumably he didn't. I haven't a clue. But I just imagine he didn't. Well, then we take the thing about him publishing his work. You know, he had these thoughts. They were important thoughts. He had already published various books. He was forbidden, and he acquiesced in that. He presumably agreed at some level, okay, you've done that to me, but I will accept. So there is some story in his life that I haven't discovered enough about, that obviously, you know, it could have become like a philosophy of almost hedonism, you know, right? You must have every experience to become the best mystic, presumably. You know, you must, you know, when in doubt,
Do it,
right? I don't know. You know, that bit of being most in touch with the earth. But presumably in his own life, and again, I know there are people who know lots about him here, much more than I do, he also, and it comes up a little in that chapter 8 where he talks about the pain of existence, you know? Not necessarily withdrew from the world, but, you know, right? You know, accepted his Jesuit vows, for example, and in that sense submitted. So I'm not sure how all of that fits into this story. Do you need that kind of thing to become a mystic? Perhaps you do. I'm not sure, you know. Does that make any sense? There has to be a kick. There has to be a suffering, too.
I was just going to say that if you see this in evidence in your classroom, if we want proof that our senses are evolving, listen and appreciate your youth as they express what they perceive and what they see in the world, and there's evolution taking place.
I'm not a cheerleader for evolution or revolution either. I mean, you know the way they all talk now about new media and all that stuff, you know, and they've got all this sort of, so they communicate differently.
Are you hopeful?
Well, am I hopeful? Of course, yes. Oh God, yes. Why not? I mean, how could you not be? Well, about 5% of the time, hopeful. Yeah, I suppose it's pretty easy to tell the opposite story too.
Hearing is devolving.
There you are. Our attention spans and everything.
Hearing, though, they really are. They hear less well than we do.
Really?
Because of all the
water. So there's consciousness greater of people all over the world at one time.
The changes surely happen more slowly than, you know, than we guess. Anyone else, or are we time up? Yes.
Before we finish, could you? We had a lot of people ask about attending your class.
Oh yeah, and I don't have the exact information, but please, just if you're interested, I'm teaching. Some people are asking me. I'm teaching a evening course on Irish, mostly Irish plays, but Irish poetry and plays. Down in the women's club in Carpinteria, which is about 20 minutes away. Actually, very easy to get to off of the freeway. But it's on Monday nights from 6 to 8 after Christmas, starting around the 1st of January. And it's offered through Cal State Channel Islands. It's a thing called the OLLI program. It used to be at UCSB and they closed it down as part of their cost cutting, and it's sort of restarted by the people down there. So I guess to find the exact details or to register, you would go to the Cal State Channel Islands website. CSUCI, whatever. And you'd look for the extension program and register through that or just find out the details of it. I also, obviously, I'm a professor at UCSB, and if you're interested in Irish things, I teach... I'm not really teaching a big course next quarter, but in the spring quarter, you know, we have quarters. From March on, I'm teaching a course on 20th century Irish literature and culture for 400 students in Lottie Lehman Concert Hall. Some of you probably know it. And I honestly don't remember. It's probably Tuesday, Thursday at 11 o'clock or 9:30 in the morning, twice a week. But if any of you are interested in those matters and would like to, you could just audit. You know, you'd be more than welcome to audit. Don't bring hundreds of people, but I will. So, thanks very much.